a kind of an advisory council to us, with whom I worked excellently together. No, better not stop it. Mm-hmm. I have to.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we counted at that time the number of visitors, scientific visitors we had, and we came to more than 300.
You keep talking, I'm going to call.
Mm-hmm. And some of a group of three was also Dr. Wattendorf, who worked closely with von Karman. Von Karman himself did not come to Kochel. Then von Karman's scientific associate, Dr. Sien, T-S-I-E-M, and I told him right away that I knew his paper, which he published with von Karman just before the war, on the pressure distribution of cones with ogives. And then was the another gentleman on, which I don't remember the name, who was later at NASA, H.L. Dryden, D-R-Y-D-E-N. I knew also Dryden's work on turbulence before the war, which was well known in Germany. About in August, after 3 months of interrogations, the final plans were made to dismantle the Kochel tunnel and to ship it to the United States. I should mention one thing, that the tunnel in Kochel, of course, during the war time, was secret. That it was working at supersonics or on rockets or ballistics. Therefore, we invented the code name Wasserbau Versuchsanstalt, which means hydro power test area. And this name was suggested by the fact that we were close to the Kochel Lake and Walchen Lake, and that we had workers and barracks in that area. Most of the people, when they saw our big tanks, which you could not hide, they thought we would work for submarine work. Suspected this. So I mention this because many of our publications at this time, they carry all the sign of Wasserbau Versuchsanstalt, or the abbreviation WVA. Yeah. Oh, yeah. WVA at Kochel. See. The coming now to the dismantling took several months of work to do this properly, and it were taken carefully, all the drawings, not all were available because we were in so rapid development, so American forces were brought in with engineers to take and also label every part, taking photographs so it could be put together again. And during all the time from the beginning of May to the end of September, I could get the support by the American forces in this respect, that for all my people who were working there, there were at least 50 of the original 240, maybe 50 to 100 working, that they all get special ration tickets, because we were so undernourished that we found that we lost part of our memory and were able only to work a few hours the day, and got very fast exhaustion. And so we received special rations in order to be able to work. Then about during August and September, the physical dismantling started, and packing in hundreds of boxes and put on the on a train of, I forgot how many cars, maybe 20 or 30 cars length, the train. And I believe it was the 28th of September or so that this train left Kochel, and I was standing with my closest associates there, realizing that this was a very important moment of the development of supersonic, hypersonic aerodynamics and rocketry. Yeah, you asked me about coming to the United States.
So the destination of all this was where?
Our destination was the United States, not more known.
You didn't know at that time?
No, not where. It was, I believe, not decided. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was a great discussion, and even we lived through some of the discussion in my office, because that was that people... officers from the Army, officers from the Navy, and officers from the Air Force, they all came and showed and tried to prove that they were the proper agency who should take over according to what we had done and in what areas we had worked. And of course, that was great pressure for us because we could take advantage of those differences to play our strongest part, whatever you can play at that, at such an at such a moment. The I had been asked, certainly after the equipment left, whom I would suggest who should from the wind tunnel associates who should go to the United States, and I had made up a list of roughly 50 scientists and engineers and also technicians who are very important for the development and running of such a very complex and advanced equipment. And however, only about 12 finally, no, excuse me, about 30 came to the United States. Yeah.
And they all went to where?
About 20 went... I forget now, 12 or to 20, went to the Naval Ordnance Laboratory in White Oaks under and Dr. Kurzweg, who had been my deputy since many years, went there, and it was their task there to reconstruct the Mach number 4.4 wind tunnel, get it in operation, and useful operation. This took from 8 and up to the summer of 49 when it was finally again operative, and the summer of 49 the official opening of this happened. It was interesting to read. Yeah. The wind tunnel was reconstructed exactly as at Peenemünde. When I came there to the opening, I had not been invited, I came by myself. And it was exactly reconstructed in Germany. Nearly every screw I found again. Only new thing was the 1,000 cubic meter tank, which had been a riveted one, and that was replaced by a more modern with welding.
That was all under Kurzweg.
That was under the Kurzweg, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. I was the Air Force.
At the Air Force, at Wright-Patterson.
At Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, yeah.
How many people did you take?
I had 7 people. Uh-huh. And those were all the ones who had specifically worked on the hypersonic wind tunnel. Mm-hmm. 2 others, Dr. Eber and Dr. Haibai, who also had worked very substantially, that is Gerhard Eber, E-B-E-R. Mm-hmm. He had been my deputy for the hypersonic wind tunnel during in Germany. Unfortunately, we did not succeed to get Dr. Eber and Dr. Haibai to Wright-Patterson for space to continue there on the hypersonic tunnel. The decision was made by the Joint Chief of Staff that the Mach number 4.4 tunnel should go to the Navy because they so far didn't have any supersonic wind tunnel. the army ordnance under Colonel Simon, Leslie Simon. Mm-hmm. He also visited for many weeks with a large crew of his associates. And they did have already a supersonic wind tunnel, obviously, but now to some, maybe Mach 3 or so, and so they're considered as already having one. And the Air Force had in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base a beautiful, continuously working supersonic tunnel, ready built just by at the end of the war, finished, with actual compressors, maybe capable of Mach 2 or 3 probably, with Larsen for continuous operation. And this tunnel, it took many years until this tunnel got really operational. Mm-hmm. So that was a distribution, and the Air Force was considered as should be in charge of the Mach number 10 development.
But why did they only allow you to bring so few people then?
The Air Force was obviously weaker because I specifically had some of the most important people designated, like Eber and Haibei, who had worked on it, mm-hmm. and they were on our list, mm-hmm. but they had been then, before coming to Wright Field, borrowed, quotation ends, by the Navy, but then for 1 month, for another month, for another mm-hmm. 6 months, and they never were released mm-hmm. by the Navy back to the Air Force. They were still Army Air Force at this time, and the Navy had a much stronger setup, obviously, mm-hmm. also scientifically. The people whom we met who were really Navy personnel, I mean, not engineers just in uniform or scientists, but really had a very strong, obviously, the strong technical tradition of the Navy came through there.
Did you ever go to Landshut at all?
Yes, only for a few days, to ask this. 28th of September was when the train left Kochel with the equipment, and about at this time, or briefly before and after, where the we were asked contracts to sign to go to the United States. About 20 also of my wind tunnel people who had been offered to go to the United States did decline because they did not want to separate from their families, and they preferred then to go to France, mm-hmm. who operated an operation right at the border between Germany and France. So they lived with the families in Germany and they worked in France. That is then later at near Freiburg, I got now the name, on the French, German-French border. It's now a joint French and German research institute for ballistics, etc. Forgot the name. And so there, for instance, Gessner, whom I had mentioned, this chief designer, he went there because he didn't want to take the risk to get separated from his family. And those of us who had more trust in the American promises, mm-hmm. we went to the United States.
When did you actually arrive in the United States?
I arrived on the 8th of November, I believe.
You went directly to
10th of November.
For
a few days. First, we went to Boston and to Fort Strong, where we stayed maybe for a week or 10 days. And then from there on, we started being distributed.
Was there any of the Pina Mundi team there at that time?
Oh, yes. When I went over the ocean, we were on the first boat. Dr. Von Braun, Dr. Reis, and the group of six, they were flown over. But then came the first boat with roughly 50 or 70 scientists from the Landshut area, where the families were. And so I actually had expected by all this I would finally end up with Dr. Von Braun in Fort Bliss. But suddenly an Air Force the group came and got me and a few others to Patterson Air Force Base.
When I spoke to Brown, did he try to put any pressure on the Army to get you from the Air Force?
I don't know. I know that he invited me as first, of course, in the first year we couldn't travel by our own. Then, summer of 46, we could travel under the accompaniment, accompanied by officers. And but it was in spring 47, when von Braun had just married and came back from Germany, he immediately invited me then to come to visit, and I had a several days visit at Fort Bliss, and we went through all the problems and the plans with Professor Karl Wagner, who had done very essential and had done very close work also with our wind tunnels and certain thermodynamics. Our wind tunnels and certain thermodynamic problems of liquefaction and so on. And Dr. von Braun asked me to come to the Army and join them there. But I felt at this time that the working condition and the expectations at the Air Force in at Patterson Air Force Base and the development of the Mach 10 tunnel there, which was my original plan, starting on the 15th of December 1941, that I should follow this up. But I promised von Braun that I would, once this tunnel was built, should be used, all what I could do at such a time to be used for the further development of the missiles and for vehicles finally going into space, because this was really in which we had been interested all the time. And maybe I should close with a little anecdote.
Okay.
Here. Going back to 1938, February 1938, we had been in Peenemünde about 8 months only, and the morale among the scientists and technicians were high on our work, but was very low at home, because we were all accustomed, came from large cities with all the cultural benefits of concert, opera, etc., and theater, and of course at Peenemünde was nothing, and we had to drive 45 kilometers to Greifswald to find a little university and a little bit of a concert, and so we were morale very down. And Ruchelt, Herman, my wife, we discussed the situation of the low morale, and she suggested we will give a Mardi Gras, which is February, March, the Mardi Gras time, in our home, a big party. And of course, a Mardi must have a subject, a title in Germany always, and its title, my wife and I at this time agreed to say, the first Mardi Gras on Mars, in 38, because we were only interested, as the V-2 as the first stage, and we wanted to build a two-stage missile and a three-stage. In two-stage, we hoped to get nearly to orbit, or two or three stages, and then from there, certainly, the space station, and from there to Mars. We even skipped the moon at that time as just an intermediate step. And and now everybody has to be dressed, of course, during a Mardi Gras party, and it was very interesting. The one of my closest associates, Dr. Lehnert, who worked in the supersonic wind tunnel, came with a special gown and a hat designed for Mach number 100, which is, by the way, translated to the orbital speed of the Earth around the Sun, and which, of course, he needs this order of magnitudes to go to Mars. In fact, a little bit more, though he anticipated this. And then Dr. Eber, who was central in the, all the heat transfer area and later for the hypersonic tunnel. He had just married a young and beautiful woman, and she came dressed as the goddess of Mars in a silver gown so tight that he had to sew her in before they came. It was not buttoned together. That was impossible. And now, Dr. von Braun, what came? He came with white hairs and dressed and behaving as a man. He never said it, but he estimated that he should be at least 72, probably more, 75 years old, and called himself Professor von Braun, which he wasn't at that time. Mm-hmm. I was wondering for days later why he came. I knew Dr. von Braun was always very optimistic when people said it would take so long. He always said, no, we have this and this and this. When we put it together, we make it much faster. And I had anticipated the trip to the Mars much earlier. And he played a 75-year-old man. Now, looking back from today, that means born 1912, that would be roughly 1985. Mm-hmm. And that is a pretty good estimate for first people maybe celebrating a few Mardi Gras on Mars. Uh-huh.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay.